Tina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget the politics. It don't get no better than this, nah. Courtroom combat going hand to hand. Two masters of the trade, conversation hot, you need a fan. It's Legal Face Off, so step into the ring. No topic off limit, cause they gon' cover everything. Now check them out on Facebook and Twitter.
We welcome you to October on Legal Face Off, WGN and WGNRadio.com. We're in the Tribune Tower on Michigan Avenue. The Legal Eagles are here with our punchy pens, Rich Lenkoff and Tina Martini. Hello.
Hello. Hello.
Welcome.
Lots to get to, per usual. We have plenty of interviews. We have five guests, count them five today. We'll talk about Club Fed. We'll talk about Aaron Hernandez and CTE, Inside Out at the end of the show, and, of course, the legal grab bag to put a ribbon on it. But first, we begin with a trifecta of topics: cell phone privacy, gerrymandering, and cake artist and LGBT marriage. We welcome back to the show Andy DeVote, who's a partner at Loeb & Loeb. He was a law clerk for Chief Justice William Rehnquist. And also joining us on the phone right now from Latham & Watkins, he's a partner, Greg Garr, also the 44th Solicitor General of the USA. Welcome both of you to WGN.
How are you?
Thanks for joining us. As always, an all-star panel for our Supreme Court discussion. So every year when the Supreme Court takes the bench for the first Monday in October, on Legal Face-Off, we preview some important cases to watch. This term is no different, has many notable cases, including ones involving issues like immigration, religious liberty, and possibly President Trump's controversial travel ban. It's also notable because it's Justice Gorsuch beginning his first full term on the bench. So let's talk first about the Gill versus Whitford gerrymandering case. It's notable for a couple of reasons, and not the least of which, I think, is there's lots of talk about the demeanor of Justice Gorsuch so far with this case and at the end of last term. Some people have criticized him as maybe lecturing. He said, for example, in the oral arguments on the Gill case, he said, maybe we can just for a second talk about the arcane matter of the Constitution. Andy, you were a clerk for the Supreme Court. Tell us what your thoughts on Justice Gorsuch so far before we get into the heart of the case.
Well, I mean, I think just like what we've seen so far is what you'd expect, that very sharp, direct questioning in a situation like this. You know, he, I think, made himself clear in where he was at. I mean, this is a case where everyone is going to be, you know, looking to Justice Kennedy and what Justice Kennedy will do. But I think on the side of the court where, whether it's they find they're not to be standing in the case at all, or if they find that the court should not be in the business of reviewing partisan gerrymandering, you're going to have Justice Gorsuch on that side and leading the charge vocally. And so I don't think it's really surprising that that he would take that tone or that tactic, oral argument in this case.
Let's back up for a second. And Greg, tell us, if you can, what the gerrymandering case is all about and why the Supreme Court decided to take it up again a short time after they last reviewed it just a few years ago.
Sure. So this case involves a challenge to the constitutionality of a redistricting plan passed by the Wisconsin Senate in 2011, which at the time was controlled by the Republicans. And the challenge in the case is that the plan is a partisan gerrymander, which means that politics played a role in crafting the plan. Oftentimes you end up with these plans that have these bizarre shapes. And the argument here is that the Republicans in charge of the Senate tried to favor future Republicans by drawing the district in a way that would ensure that Republicans would be elected. And the Supreme Court has had open for a long time the question of whether or not you can challenge a district on the grounds that is unconstitutional because it is a partisan gerrymander. You can challenge it on the ground under the 14th Amendment that it was gerrymandered on the basis of race, but the court has never squarely resolved the question of whether you can challenge it under the Constitution as a partisan gerrymander. 13 years ago, they had a case called Veith versus Jubilier, in which the court essentially split 4-4 in that question, with four of the justices saying these sorts of claims just aren't cognizable under the Constitution, four saying, yeah, bring it on, and Justice Kennedy basically saying, well, I'm not sure yet. Go back and see if you can come back with a better principle for determining whether or not there's actually some kind of constitutional partisan gerrymander. And so here we are 13 years later. The case is back before the court, and all eyes are on Justice Kennedy, as Andy mentioned.
But Andy, shouldn't – thanks for that summary, Greg. Andy, shouldn't the courts just leave this alone? I mean, isn't there no real obvious way to determine, you know, whether gerrymandering is a result of partisanship?
Well, I mean, I don't know if that, in terms of whether or not it's about partisanship, I think that that's the clear question. It is. It's just a question of, does it go so far, right? At oral argument, Justice Ginsburg talked about the precious right to vote is at the heart of the case. And if the legislature is going to stack if a legislator can stack the legislature, you know, would the result be the election be preordained, I think is the word she used. And so the idea here is that, you know, it clearly is politics. It is partisan politics, but does it go so far that you're talking about it impeding in a way, as Greg said, that you get involved in it and that it would violate the Constitution? And I think you did have different justices. For example, I think Justice Breyer, the real business is, if you're going to apply a standard, what are you going to do? You have the judge who wrote the opinion of the district court. It's a three-judge panel. It's very unique in these gerrymandering cases. You have a three-judge panel, and Judge Ripple, I believe, who from the Seventh Circuit, wrote, I think it's a 120-page opinion, very complicated, thorough review. And I think a lot of people think this is the business of getting into this thicket and trying to unpack it and find a workable standard is really one of the big challenges. So I think that's something you're going to see. I imagine you're going to get multiple opinions on the issue of whether you get involved, and then similarly, if you do, you know, what the appropriate standard would be.
So the Chief Justice, during oral argument, called this thing called the efficiency gap, which they came up with as the principle, as sociological gobbledygook, which sort of characterized the right's view and all that. And as Andy mentioned, I mean, from the right, from the left perspective, this is literally democracy at stake here. And all eyes were on Justice Kennedy, who, seemed to have some fairly tough questions for those defending the Wisconsin plan and suggesting that maybe he would view this as a violation of the First Amendment, that if you had a legislature that was trying to draw a plan that just favored one party, in effect they were favoring the views of that party or speech, and that would contravene a First Amendment principle, which would be a new constitutional doctrine if it were adopted by the full court.
So, gentlemen, switching gears, another case that a lot of folks are keeping their eye on relates to cell phone privacy. That is the Carpenter v. United States case that I think is slated to be heard in December. In that case, what's being decided is whether police officers are going to be required to obtain warrants to get data that is generated by cell phone use on their past locations to determine whether or not they were in fact in the vicinity of a particular crime and a prime suspect. Andy, would you like to tee that case up for us and just let our listeners know what the main issues are here?
Absolutely. And this is a case, although the Supreme Court has gotten younger with recent appointments, I remember my constitutional law professor, John Nowak, saying the beauty of the Supreme Court is you have your grandparents deciding constitutional law, and oversimplifying it for us first years. And it is interesting because you have the justices and you have this issue with technology and, you know, the real cross section between constitutional rights and technology. It's not a blank slate. In 2014, there was a case, Riley versus California, and the issue there was getting certain data actually off the phone, like, you know, substantive data off the phone, pictures, emails, and the like. And there the court ruled you had to have, the police officers had to have a warrant. But here the question is whether or not they have to have a warrant or whether they can get that information from their service providers. As you said, this information of basically where they ping off of the cell phone towers. As a prosecutor, as a law enforcement agent, when you're trying to put someone in the location or area of a crime, in this case, this individual had been found to be involved in a number of armed robberies and actually received 116 years in prison. So the stakes are high. And his position was that the officer should have had a warrant to get this information from the service providers in terms of where his cell phone was pinging off of cell phone towers. And so the question for the justices will be where that line is. Is this data different than the data that is pulled off the phone that you do need a warrant for, your text messages and the like? So it should be, I think it should be a really interesting case. The government obviously is coming in from the position that they don't need the warrant and that this information is different. And an interesting point they'd say as well is that in terms of your privacy expectation, that you should have the general understanding of how a cell phone works and it pings off of towers such that this that you would know that this data would be out there and not have some sort of privacy expectation, you know, that one would say is akin to maybe your text message on your cell phone.
Greg, you're, as we mentioned, former Solicitor General of the United States. For our listeners who don't know what that means, you are the federal government's attorney before the Supreme Court. How important is it for the Solicitor General to push forward cases like this and be aggressive when it comes to pursuing evidence on behalf of the government, from your perspective?
Well, so in this case, the Solicitor General is representing the United States, whose prosecutors sought to get this information and investigating a string of bank robberies in Detroit. So they're playing the role of the prosecutor here, and oftentimes once the case gets to the Solicitor General's office, the government is you know, in a way, sort of stuck with defending the criminal prosecution. You know, the United States hasn't exactly had the best record before the court recently in these Fourth Amendment cases, and I think it's fair to say that, generally speaking, the justices are wary of adopting Fourth Amendment principles that can limit their own privacy, and it's also fair to say that although they're old, all the justices probably carry cell phones. I mean, there was a case years ago where dealt with the question of whether you could stick a tracking device on a car, and the key moment of the oral argument came when the Chief Justice said to the lawyer for the argument, "You mean you could stick one of these on my car?" And that's where their case went downhill. And I think that's going to be the challenge they have here.
Last case before we let you go on Legal Face-Off deals with one of the most controversial issues, pitting religious liberty against LGBT rights. Greg, can you tell us a little bit about the case involving Jack Phillips?
Sure. So this case involves a baker in Colorado who runs the Masterpiece Cape Shop and is a devout Christian. A couple came in and asked him to bake a wedding cake for a gay marriage ceremony, and he declined. He said he would bake them a cake for anything else and they could buy anything else, but he didn't feel comfortable baking a cake for their wedding ceremony. And the way the case is pitched before the Supreme Court is, on the one hand, the baker at this point is really arguing that this is all about free expression, that baking is literally a form of art, and that forcing him to express himself in connection with something that he's opposed to based on his religious beliefs would violate his First Amendment speech rights. And then on the other side is the Colorado Civil Rights Commission, which is enforcing the public accommodations laws, and these laws have been upheld for decades as part of the civil rights cases before the Supreme Court, which of course say that, look, if you're going to open your business up to the public, then you have to serve everyone. You can't discriminate against customers on the basis of prohibited characteristics, and here it would be on the basis of the fact that they want to have a gay marriage as opposed to another type of marriage.
And I think to your prior question to Greg about the role of the Solicitor General, this is an interesting case in that here the Trump administration is weighing in on the side of the bakery and saying, although to Greg's good point that law, you know, goods and services accommodation laws have been held up for years, that there are certain laws that if they're applied, that they would alter someone's speech or compel that person to participate in an event that conflicts with their beliefs, that law would go too far. And so you do have the Trump administration weighing in on the side of bakery here, saying that the law goes beyond just to goods and services. So I think to Greg's good description, it's sort of how you view the law and who's successful in casting the law, you know, in sort of one category versus the other.
Yeah, and if you find in favor, I mean, one of the issues, obviously, is if you find in favor of the baker, I mean, where does it stop? The Supreme Court has already, in 2015, established that the Constitution guarantees the right to same-sex marriage. So if you're saying that a bakery has a free speech right to discriminate, then, you know, at least according to the, you know, LGBT community, then any business that can argue that they engage in expression have the right to get around that ruling and discriminate. I mean, where does it stop? I mean, what if it's a restaurant, a jeweler, hair salon photographer, right? Anyone who's involved with marriage can now, if the case goes their way, discriminate and basically do an end around this monumentous decision by the Supreme Court.
I think that's right. I mean, and I think that's the way that the Colorado Civil Rights Commission is pitching it, and with good reason, given the venerable history of the public accommodations laws. And, you know, once again, all eyes are on Justice Kennedy. I mean, he'll no doubt be very sensitive to those concerns. And he, of course, wrote the landmark same-sex marriage ruling a few years ago. On the other hand, you know, as we discussed in the partisan gerrymandering case, he's also very much a fan of the First Amendment. And no doubt that explains why the Bakers here have pitched us as a First Amendment cake about the venerable First Amendment right of expressing ourselves through cakes.
Greg Gar with us on Legal Face-Off on WGN. Thank you both so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He has been selected to the 2012 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2016. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEAK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Their clients enjoy a hand-picked team of attorneys supported by a world-class staff. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
Welcome you back to Legal Face-Off on WGN and WGNRadio.com. Joining us now on the phones, he is a Pulitzer Prize-nominated journalist. He spent many years for the New York Times and wrote a new piece on Deadspin, Deadspin.com, about CTE and Aaron Hernandez. Alan Schwarz with us on WGN Radio. Hello, Alan.
How are you doing?
Great. So last week, the attorney for the former New England Patriots tight end, Aaron Hernandez, announced a $20 million lawsuit that he had filed in federal court against the New England Patriots and the NFL on behalf of Hernandez's former fiancée and the daughter. They're alleging that his CTE was caused by his time in the NFL and that the league and the team were, quote, fully aware of the damage that could be inflicted from repetitive impact injuries and failed to disclose, treat, or protect him from the dangers of such damage. Obviously, the NFL has come out and vigorously denied those claims and intend to contest the lawsuit. Your piece, Alan, talks about the relationship, alleged relationship between CTE and criminal behavior. Could you give us some background, first of all, on the work that you've done in this area?
Well, I was the guy, I guess, matter of historical record. I wrote 130 articles exposing CTE and the NFL's cover-up of brain damage in players and more of a public health issue of concussions in young athletes. And so I know my share about CTE and what it can do, you know, what it has done, what it can do, and what the limitations of it are, at least as we stand now with respect to the science. The fact that the attorney is alleging that the NFL, you know, that this all happened, that he murdered somebody and then had CTE, you know, was caused by the NFL's negligence, I think says more about the lawyer than it does about the actual science. I think that, you know, you can allege a lot of things. Proving them is quite another.
So talk to us about the science, because you're the expert on this. You've written more than 100 articles about the relationship between CTE and behavior, and specifically the Boston University study is what many cite to as evidence of this alleged relationship. What's your thoughts on this BU study?
Well, there's no question, okay? And what the BU study has said is that, you know, a vast majority of NFL players and even players below the NFL, football players, have developed chronic traumatic encephalopathy to various degrees. Okay, and it is also known that chronic traumatic encephalopathy can affect behavior. It can make you make you impulsive. memory loss, dementia, forgetfulness, but, you know, impulsivity is part of it. And so one can ask himself, golly, you know, obviously Aaron Hernandez performed a couple of very notable impulsive acts, or at least poorly thought out acts. And, you know, was that to was CTE to blame somehow? And that is an extraordinary leap to make. I think sometimes it's more fair than others. But Aaron Hernandez clearly had a history of a lot of this stuff. He entered the league with a lot of his, you know, behavioral baggage. And I think it's a pretty tough sell to me to say that the 3 years, I think it was, that he played in the NFL turned him into this beast. And, you know, I understand that the lawyer wants to allege that, but also saying that the NFL failed to warn, blah, blah, blah. I'm not sure if any football player from 2010 to 2012 didn't know about the risks of chronic traumatic encephalopathy.
Alan, the title of your piece on Deadspin, it says the CTE drove Aaron Hernandez's narrative is too convenient. And I agree with you, because when you look at the crowds he rolled with in high school, he was rolling around Connecticut with gangbangers. He got in trouble in a bar at University of Florida for smashing a beer bottle over somebody's head. I find it very stretchy, and I sort of agree that it's too convenient to just lob this in with CTE. He was a bad guy before he played football.
Well, I mean, that, you said it, not me.
Fine. That's fine, and I'll stand by it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that is a very reasonable way to look at it. I mean, look, maybe you're wrong in the same way that maybe we're wrong when we say that people's behavior was affected by CTE. But the thing is that since we really don't know, I think that accusing or blaming Hernandez's behavior on CTE and the NFL, I think, frankly, does a disservice
right
to all the people, all the players whose lives really have been transformed by CTE. And, you know, I understand that he's the most notable guy and has the most notable story, et cetera, et cetera, Junior Seau notwithstanding. But it's just, it's not going to work rhetorically. I mean, this lawsuit, they will never, ever, ever win.
Well, to that point,
Perry Mason to know that.
Yeah, and I agree wholeheartedly. And to that point, I mean, from a legal perspective, I know you're not an attorney, but from a legal perspective, just to underline what you just said, there's so many reasons in addition to that why the lawsuit, you know, should be dismissed summarily. I mean, first of all, as you point out a little bit in your piece, it's almost impossible to prove causation in these kind of cases, right? I mean, Aaron Hernandez played in the NFL for a few years. He played outside the NFL for many more years. Most of these players who are alleging a relationship between CTE and the NFL will not be able to prove causation. And causation is right. A condition precedent to winning that case. How do you prove that the 2 or 3 years you spend in the NFL is the reason for your condition versus the many years beforehand? That's one fatal flaw.
I think that's one of the reasons why, of course, they did a class action.
Right.
Is because then you don't have the same burden of proof on an individual basis. And, you know, I've written more about this and arguably know more about this than anybody. And if I were on a jury, I mean, I understand that it's likely, quite likely. But, you know, if it's, I know it's not a criminal case, but beyond a reasonable doubt, if it's something like that, you know, that's a tough sell.
Right. And exactly why, you know, there was that give and take in the class action. A lot of people felt that the players got too little. I, in fact, felt that the players got too little. I mean, they got a drop in the bucket versus what they could have got. But, you know, the reality is causation was a very, very hard burden to overcome. In addition, you know, there's many other reasons why the case should be dismissed. I mean, there's a collective bargaining agreement that, you know, this case should go to. This case should go to mediation if it survives. The very reason that you have these terms in the CBA is to avoid these cases going to a jury.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with that. Now,
that's why we call a legal face-off.
Yes. I mean, I think that with every contract, there's a covenant of good faith. And I believe that certainly to a certain point, and certainly until 2007 and through 2009 and to varying degrees afterwards, the NFL deliberately and knowingly obfuscated the dangers of this sport. and as such, misled their employees with regard to how much asbestos was in the walls. That, to me, would at least open up the can of worms of whether there was a violation of the good faith assumption in whatever contract, you know, collectively bargained contract there may be. I mean, fraud, you know, is not something that necessarily, you know, falls under the regular umbrella. And so, I mean, that's just my opinion, which is based on a dangerously small amount of law school, which is to say zero. But I've kept my ear to that ground pretty good.
Last thing, Alan, we appreciate your time here on WGN. I cover high school football here in Chicago. I do a show on Friday nights, and I talk to coaches, and a lot of times you get to talk to parents, too, when you're out at games or what have you. And the lack of knowledge, you know, 10 years ago about CTE was pretty telling. Now parents are not letting their kids play football. Enrollment in the Illinois high school football is down 30%. Have you dealt with any of these studies? Have you talked to any parents about the future of football and what might happen because of all these brain injuries?
To be honest, I've been out of the game for a while. I wrote that guest essay on Deadspin as sort of a one-off. I think that participation in football has gone down in some communities and not in others. I don't think it's actually going to end up being that big of a deal. Some leagues will consolidate, and that's fine. But, you know, it's an understandable reaction. But then again, you know, to be fair, some parents didn't allow their kids to play football before I ever showed up and before CTE was ever an issue. So, you know, I don't want to overestimate. I mean, your citation of 30% is a big one. That's the biggest I've ever heard, frankly. You know, the future of football, I think football is going to be fine. It's just going to adapt.
The website, alanschwarz.net, S-C-H-W-A-R-Z, Alan Schwarz, a Pulitzer Prize nominated journalist. He spent many years for the New York Times. We appreciate your time here on WGN.
My pleasure. Anytime.
We're on Facebook, we're on Twitter, we're on iTunes. All you have to do is search for Legal Faceoff on WGN Radio. Rich Lenkov and Tina Martini. My name is Sam Paniatovich. Joining us now, he is extremely colorful, Larry Levine, who is the director and founder of Wall Street Prison Consultants. He does plenty of things, and we'll learn more about him throughout this interview. But first, Larry, welcome to WGN Radio.
Hey, glad to be with you.
Larry, before you join us, I want to ask a question here of our moderator, Sam, and my co-host, Tina. So bocce ball, continental breakfast, pool table, a full gym, basketball court, a greenhouse.
Hey, that sounds like someone's going to a resort.
It sounds like a nice
You stepped all
hotel.
Over my lead, Larry. But my question is this a description of an amazing resort hotel, or
actually, that's the Gray Bar Hotel, but there's no fences and there's no bars.
Larry's coming in hot. Yeah, that is not, in fact, a resort hotel, but it is the luxury Pennsylvania prison where Anthony Weiner has been sentenced to 21 months for sexually explicit material. That's a lie. Well, tell us why. Go ahead.
Okay. Anthony Weiner is not going to go to a club-fed camp. Anthony Weiner has a public safety factor on him, and they're going to put a management variable on him.
What does that mean?
It means he's a threat to the community. In other words, any other person who really has no criminal history that picked up a 21-month sentence, and that 21 months, when you give him good time and you give him some halfway house, it's really only 15 months, they would go to a minimum security institution.
That does have bocce ball, right?
Even the lows and the mediums have bocce. But, yeah, right. The thing is, he's a threat to the community because he's a sex offender. He's going to go behind the fence. He's going to be in a federal correctional institute, not a federal prison camp, and he's going to be rubbing shoulders with bank robbers, my drug dealers, other violent offenders. They will not. He will never see a camp, not with his charges. Either will that other idiot, the Martin Shkreli,
the farmer bro.
Yeah, that idiot. He's never going to see a camp either. He
Wait a second. This might be a client of yours. Be careful.
Yeah, really.
Don't you want them
to
retain you?
Yeah, you've got to consult with him.
Tell my clients that they're morons anyway. I do. See, I don't know who's dumber, you or your lawyer. I'm just like a straight shooter when I tell people things. The point is, either one of these people are going to go to a camp. Public safety factors. And in Congressman Wiener's situation, he's got issues because, first of all, he cried in the courtroom. That's bad. Inmates have access to TV. They read USA Today and everything. They know what's going on.
So there's no crying in prison is what you're telling us?
Well, okay, the inmates are going to view him as a whiny crybaby bitch. Not kidding. They will. They know this guy's a crybaby. That's his first strike. Second strike, he's a chomo. Chomo, child molester, sex offender. Doesn't matter the circumstance. He's going to have that jacket branded on him. Somebody's going to get in his face. Someone's going to try to check his ass. And when they do that, I already know this guy's like demeanor, he's going to run to the cops. As soon as he runs to the cops to tell on somebody, now he's a rat. So he's a whiny,
Wiener,
child molester.
Well, I think you forgot the word bitch in there. Don't forget the bitch reference.
Well, okay, whiny, crybaby, snitch, bitch.
There we go.
Okay? Let's get it all in there. And his no one will hang with these people. When you have a snitch jacket, you got a chomo jacket on you, that's your persona, no one's going to be your friend. Nobody wants to have that stigma that you're running with these people.
Craig Collins, hang on. Craig, are we still on the air, Craig Collins? Are we still? Standards and practices are running in from WGN as we speak. But Tina Martinez got a question for you, Larry.
So other than knowing that folks like Anthony Weiner are not entitled to go to Club Fed, who does go to Club Fed?
Martha Stewart
and Blago.
OJ?
No, Blago, he's not at Club Fed.
Well, he's at a Club Fed-like facility.
Okay. There's different types of federal prisons. He may actually end up in Club Fed because he's been in long enough. You have what's called a minimum security camp, federal prison camp. No fence around it. They don't even lock the doors at night. Then you have an FCI low, and that's people serving 10 or more. And dormitory living, but there's two fences. You got some violent offenders in there. That's where the pharmaceutical idiot and the congressman are going. You go one step above that, you got a medium security FCI. That's cell living. That's really dangerous. People doing life sentences. One step above that, high security, and that's a United States penitentiary. Do you know what the term penitentiary derives from?
No, I'm
tell
afraid
us.
To ask.
I think you're about to tell us.
Repenting for your crimes. So these people are all at higher-level institutions. This is all like a misnomer. I've seen on different news reports saying, a Wiener's been sentenced to this particular place. Not happening.
So we've extensively covered, Larry, on this show, obviously the Blagojevich trial, the Blagojevich incarceration, O.J.'s release. We just saw O.J. released, what, 3 days ago?
Yeah, a couple days ago. He thought he was going, God, the you know what, the misinformation that is fed to the news media. He's going to Florida. He's going to leave Nevada. Well, first of all, OJ's on state parole. When you're on parole, you're still in custody. You still belong to the Department of Corrections. It's not like somebody's on probation or they just had good time. They could grab him for any reason. He's still technically under arrest, but he's out on the street. Florida has to agree to accept him, and they don't want him, and Nevada has to agree to let him go. And I don't see that happening. Maybe in a few years when he can demonstrate that he's a good citizen, they're not going to really look at what his character was in prison. They need to evaluate him now that he has freedom.
So, Larry, you let you go with about 60 seconds left. Tell us the most accurate prison movie of all time, in your opinion. What movie most accurately depicts life in prison? There's been a million of them, obviously, but what really gets it right?
You know what? I don't think any of them.
Why?
I don't think any of them really do. I mean, all these prison movies that you're seeing, I tell my clients, I don't want you watching Oz. I don't want you watching Shawshank Redemption. Don't watch Orange is the New Black. All of them take excerpts, and they try to make things interesting for the viewer. prisons are all different. You've got to watch your back 24/7 because the can just jump off at any time. And you don't want to get caught up in that storm, you know? Best thing people, when they're going into custody, avoid drama, avoid politics. Do your time. Don't do somebody else's time. Mind your own business. Show the ultimate respect, and you know what? Maybe you'll get out of there in one piece.
That's Larry Levine, director and founder of Wall Street Prison Consultants. We have the bleep button. I think the button is actually broken.
instantly in our top five guest Hall of Fame.
This was great. We will have to have you back on. Thanks, Larry.
In our last segment before the grab bag on Legal Face-Off, we're joined in studio by, shockingly, Tina Martini from Inside Out, Chicago Lawyer Magazine's Inside Out columnist, who writes the monthly column with David Susler. David Susler is Associate General Counsel with National Material LP. He is also the, as I mentioned, co-columnist from Chicago Lawyer Magazine's Inside Out. How many years are we going on for the column?
7.5 years. We started in April of 2010.
At what point are you just regurgitating topics?
Well, you know, it's funny. David
Craig
asks
Collins
me
believes that
every that
some of these are familiar to our listeners, just Dave, with some different.
Not this one.
This one's different. And we we've got another one coming out in the next few weeks. We're going to give you a quick sneak preview about dealing with office politics.
Well, that's going to be a great one. But this one we're going to talk about today is from the October 5th edition of Chicago Lawyer, available at ChicagoLawyerMagazine.com. And, of course, in print. I still read the print one. I get that every month. And the topic that you're covering is managing management. So tell us, Tina, first of all, why is project management so important for lawyers?
Project management's very important for lawyers, especially now that clients, especially since the last recession, have really been looking to their law firms to not only deliver terrific legal services, but to also do it in a very expeditious and cost-effective manner. And so project management enables you to wrap your arms around a particular project and break it down into its constituent pieces and figure out the best ways to get the deliverable to the client, and figuring out how to do the staffing in an appropriate way, how to make sure that you use certain efficiencies where you can use even artificial intelligence, for example, to get certain aspects of the work done, partner with in-house counsel who can maybe help you get certain parts of the project done. These are the sorts of things that clients are looking for and expecting, and that's why it's so important.
Have you ever done the marshmallow and spaghetti challenge? David, Tina? So this morning, I told you I was on a plane from L.A. at 6 a.m. I was yesterday in California with a client of mine, the Cheesecake Factory. They have a national meeting of all their attorneys. And the icebreaker was a project management technique. And what we had, and we had 20 minutes to figure it out, was a marshmallow, some spaghetti, 20 strands of uncooked spaghetti.
It was uncooked.
Uncooked.
Okay.
Some tape. And some string, and the challenge for the 200 or so people in the room, we broke up into groups of about five, was to build the tallest structure with a freestanding marshmallow. So you couldn't hold it. And at the end of it, there was a TED Talk about, you know, what goes into managing this process. Of course, teamwork. And the group that did the best with the project turned out to be kindergartners.
Nice.
And there's a whole, you know, explanation of why. Ours, of course, I thought we were in the lead. And right when the clock went off, our marshmallow fell to the ground. I tell you that whole story because it illustrates, I think, some of what you're talking about and the importance of teamwork and managing the process. You both have engineering backgrounds.
No, actually, David does not. He's got a history.
Well, you probably would have done better, Tina, with this project because it does have an engineering component. But David, tell us from your perspective as in-house counsel why project management is important for your tasks and also when you hire outside counsel, which was, by the way, the longest setup for that question in history. It was like a five-minute monologue before I gave it to
you
David.
Now have 10 seconds,
exactly.
David.
30-second question.
It's me,
so,
me, me.
So for my work in the in-house world, it's especially important because I can't manage my legal work in a vacuum. I, at the outset of managing a product,
project is to figure out who are the stakeholders, what's the ultimate goal, how are the business people planning to get to their end result, where does the legal component fit in to that, and how do I support them in reaching their end goal. And I have to start out having a lot of conversations, which is often very interesting because sometimes the business people haven't thought about all those issues yet.
So how much of that do you – so just to break it, how much of that do you map out in advance? Because this actually came up in our project. How much of that do you map out in advance versus trial and error?
Well, I don't use formal project tools, project management tools. I don't use Gantt charts. Some of the business people here use Gantt charts and other project management.
What is
tools.
That? What is a Gantt chart?
A Gantt chart
is a type of bar graph that shows timelines for different segments of the overall project, so you can figure out start times and end times, so you understand what's coming next and when you have to start marshaling
and what the limiting factors are. And like,
so you don't use those, Tina? You use those in your role?
Well, I use it in my brain. I mean, I learned about it in my industrial engineering training about project management and making sure that you get things done in a timely fashion, especially when you've got things that you're it's especially in the manufacturing context when you've got parts and things that need to be delivered and need to be refined in a certain amount of time. Using a Gantt chart or something like a Gantt chart can be very helpful. So,
how many Gantt charts are involved in the Sestini household? For our listeners who don't know,
Sestini.
Sestini, in addition to columnists, they are our friends here are married, and we call them collectively Sestini. When you guys are deciding, you know, Thai food versus Korean barbecue, how many Gantt charts are involved?
Gantt charts. Only three.
Three.
No, but let me go back to, you know, to your answer, to your question. So I don't necessarily have to make it up on the fly, but, you know, I have the advantage of 30 years of experience in doing this. And what's interesting, you know, I spent the first 12 years of my career as a trial attorney, and I've done a lot of litigation in-house as well. And when I first learned of project management, which is when I first went in-house, and I realized, hey, managing litigation is project management. I just didn't use the formal tools. So, you know, for me, luckily, I have 30 years of experience in doing this. And like Tina said, I do it in my brain. I know pretty much what types of things we have to figure out at the outset because I know what our end goal is. I find out what our end goal is, and then I have to figure out what does it take to get there. And so it's easy for me to map it out. Now, if it's a large, complex deal that's going to take months or years, I may write out a formal chart or put reminders in my calendar that, hey, something is coming up. So I put a tickler, you know, this is due in 4 weeks, this is due in 2 weeks, this is due in 1 week. So I know the deadlines are coming.
All right, David Susser, we would be remiss if we didn't, of course, turn to your other passion besides the charts that we just referenced, which is music.
Forget about me.
Yeah, exactly. Besides your many passions, one of which is your co-host, you turned down my offer to join me in Toronto last weekend for Bruce Springsteen. You also turned down my offer to see Steve Van Zandt Sunday.
I have my Disciples of Soul T-shirt.
Yes.
From when I saw Steve and the Disciples of Soul on their first tour in either 81 or 82.
Was that the Men Without Women album?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, classic. Well, we would be remiss if we didn't tap into one of Springsteen's contemporaries. Tom Petty unfortunately passed away earlier this week. And any Tom Petty memories in the Sestini musical bank?
Wow.
Have you seen Tom Petty in concert?
Twice.
No, I almost did this summer, but I didn't. And I regret it.
I saw him in 1985 at the very first Farm Aid concert.
Yeah.
And then
is that in Champaign?
1987 in Champaign.
Right.
And then in 87, when Tom Petty and Bob Dylan toured together, because my understanding is Dylan and Petty met at Farm Aid, and they toured together in 87, saw him at Poplar Creek. Best Bob Dylan show I ever saw. And Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers were unbelievable.
Well, and then that led to the Wilburys, I think.
Oh,
right?
The Wilburys were incredible.
Yeah, I mean, most of the Wilburys are gone now. I think the only living one is Bob Dylan and then Jeff Lynne.
Who would have thought that Bob Dylan would be the surviving member of the Wilburys?
Not I.
Yeah, Wilburys were great. Well, as always, we value your opinions, not just in the legal world, but in the musical world, David Susser. Thank you for joining us, Tina Martini. David Susser, you know them as the co-authors, co-columnists of Inside Out magazine, or Inside Out column in Chicago Lawyer magazine. Again, the October 5th edition is Managing Management. Can be found at chicagolawyermagazine.com.
Thank
see
you, Richard.
See you next time.
And it's time for the Legal Grab Bag on WGN, WGNradio.com. Seven topics to get to, but I believe I am in for a parole meeting here after Larry Levine's interview, so I'm going to let you guys handle the first two topics.
Checking in with your parole officer.
I may be in trouble. I'm getting summoned right now.
So, Tina, we learned over the last couple of days that there's a local connection to the Las Vegas shooter. Tell us about that.
Yes, yeah, so we are all still reeling from the horrific events over the weekend, the terrible massacre where Stephen Paddock fatally shot 58 people, and then he killed himself and injured more than 500 people at the Jason Aldean concert. We have come to learn that it looks like he was scoping out Chicago as being a possible venue for the horrible massacre that he inflicted on all of these folks in Las Vegas. Apparently, he booked a room at the Blackstone Hotel overlooking Lollapalooza, but never, in fact, showed up for Lollapalooza. And it looks like the Boston Globe recently reported that he may have also been scoping out Boston venues, including Fenway Park, as a potential venue for his awful activities before he settled on Las Vegas.
Yeah, I mean, you know, who knows what was in this psycho's, you know, head, how many victims he was targeting. You know, the concert in Vegas held up to 22,000 people. You know, we learned this morning that he was also shooting at the oil tanks, the gas tanks by the airport. So, yeah, thankfully he didn't get to Chicago. In a related story, there's a CBS VP, an attorney, who was fired after some unfortunate comments that she made on social media.
Yes. Her name is Haley Geftman-Gold, and she was a VP senior counsel with CBS. And right after the shooting, she posted a comment saying that country music fans are often Republican and Republicans are generally opposed to gun control. She then went on to say that if they wouldn't do anything when children were murdered, she has no hope that repugs, is what she called them, will ever do the right thing. Then she said, quote, "I'm actually not even sympathetic because country music fans are Republican gun toters." Immediately after she posted this comment on Facebook, she was terminated by CBS. And in a statement to Fox, CBS stated, quote, "This individual who was with us for approximately 1 year violated the standards of our company and is no longer an employee of CBS. Her views as expressed on social media are deeply unacceptable to all of us at CBS. Our hearts go out to the victims in Las Vegas and their families."
And as you would imagine, on social media, she's now getting completely killed. As you would expect, she's a former lawyer at a firm called Heller Ehrman. As you mentioned, she was senior counsel of strategic transactions at CBS, went to Columbia Law School, and she has now reported to the NYPD that she's being threatened. She's in fear for her life. I read this morning on the airplane some of the comments. As you can imagine, I mean, they're pretty vitriolic. But yeah, I mean, you know, it always amazes me how stupid people continue to be on
social media.
You know, if you have those repugnant feelings, which any reasonable person would consider them, you know, horrific statements, keep them to yourself.
Yes.
Especially if you're employed by a major corporation like CBS.
Yeah, and if you're a lawyer, subject to licensing and all of that. And it's amazing to me that just even among the people that I know on social media, that they see Facebook in particular as an appropriate vehicle to report anything and everything that they're thinking and doing at any given time, which is still very shocking to me that people would do that and think they can still remain employed with some of the things that they say.
Amazing.
We are not we're not going to be punished for Larry Levine, so I can resume my duties here. On to the Cubs. They are in an issue with trademarks. They're defending their World Series title, of course, their series against the Nationals, but a couple issues. Fly the W, protect the C.
Yeah, so we actually covered this story. It seems like a yearly story. We covered this a year ago when the Cubs were starting their World Series championship run, and the Cubs were aggressive then, and they continue to be aggressive now in going after trademark infringement. I mean, any of us who have been up at Wrigley, or for that matter, any ballpark, you know, you often see people selling stuff out of garbage bags. The Cubs have been very aggressive, both with their attorneys and with law enforcement, in going after these illegal trademarks. The Cubs happen to be the most their mark is the most violated one in Major League Baseball. The second one is the Yankees. But the Cubs, because of the nature of their mark, it's a C. You know, it's so easy to use that in other contexts. The New York Yankees have the interlocking N and Y, but the Cubs have to constantly go after, I think, you know, rightfully so, others for using their mark.
They've opposed a trademark application 47 times this year.
Yeah.
So they've gone after 47 different companies or individuals or what have you that have tried to use their C or W.
Yeah, I mean, literally, it's to the point where they are, you know, they have street teams out there at Wrigley going up to people and, you know, threatening to sue them unless they cease and desist. So, you know, hopefully the Cubs will have enjoy another long run in the playoffs, but I think you'll continue to see people trying to violate their mark.
Here's a heavyweight fight
for you.
What's
the prediction, by the way?
I think the Cubs win the series against Washington.
Really?
Yes.
Despite the better pitching by the Nationals, depending on Scherzer, of course.
See, when everybody says that the other team is way better, I always go the other way.
Well, the Nats have a long history of folding in the playoffs.
They have Dusty Baker.
That's true. Unsuccessful.
Good old Dusty Baker.
Somebody said he's a better manager. Like, the papers were saying they were ranking offense, defense, pitching, manager, and some people said Dusty was a better manager.
Okay, I think he is a better manager.
I'm sorry, I don't agree with that. He's not a better manager.
Joe Maddon almost blew the World Series like six times last year.
Dusty Baker blew 2003. Anyways, heavyweight fight. Ready for this fight? This is a big brawl. F. Lee Bailey against the IRS.
Yes.
There's nothing like an 85-year-old man going up against the IRS, right?
Who's favored here?
Not F. Lee Bailey, okay. Even though he is
one of our favorites. Speaking of Club Fed, by the way.
He was on our show.
Welcome in,
He was. He's such a nice guy. So don't pick on F. Lee Bailey.
I'm just asking who the favorite is.
IRS, all the time.
All right.
Whether it's F. Lee Bailey or anyone else.
Undefeated, IRS.
Yes. So scrolling back, over the last couple of years, F. Lee Bailey, a treasured guest of Legal Face-Off, filed for bankruptcy in federal court in Maine in an attempt to discharge a federal tax debt of nearly $5.2 million. As we've discussed before on the show, the money is owed from a dispute over his reported income from 1993 to 2001, which is linked to a case that he actually took and which led to his disbarment in 2001 in Florida when he represented a defendant in a shady stock case where his client had pleaded guilty to money laundering and drug smuggling. So the upshot is Bailey failed to report some of his stock as income, which led to a $5.2 million penalty and interest on the amount that was due and owing. So when you fast forward to this week, just as his former client O.J. Simpson was released from prison, a bankruptcy judge decided in favor of the IRS and said that they could enforce a federal tax lien on more than $1,000 a month in income that F. Lee Bailey has in pensions, which he received from the Screen Actors Guild, United Airlines, and Social Security. Unfortunately, his Chapter 7 bankruptcy filing did not eliminate his tax burden and the lien that the IRS had on his personal property. So it's a little bit ironic that while OJ's pensions, very same pensions, are fully protected, F. Lee Bailey, unfortunately, has to pay over $1,000 a month to the IRS.
Well, he's still got the stipend that he received for appearing on Legal Face-Off to tie him over.
He got a pen that
explodes in your face.
Yes. Let's we should have a Dream Team reunion on our show because we've had, let's go through. We've had F. Lee Bailey.
Dershowitz.
Alan Dershowitz, of course. We've had Carl Douglas. We're only missing Robert Kardashian, who
he passed away.
Yet.
No, can't he cannot.
Have, can't have Johnny Cochran
can't
either.
Can't have Johnny Cochran.
But we could have who, the last member is...
Who did Travolta play in the...
Yeah. Eyebrows.
Come on. Come on.
Legal Zoom.
Tina.
Why are you looking at me?
Because you should know this.
God, I can't
because I'm the Rain Man of trivia?
Yes.
I can't believe I forget that name. But yeah, he's the last one we need to have on. He's the founder of LegalZoom, isn't he?
What is his name?
All right, we'll come back to it.
No, hold on. I need to think about this. Robert.
Robert.
Shapiro.
Shapiro, of course.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry,
oh,
Robert.
Oh, no, now Tina remembers. It's all coming back like a night in college. Mom bloggers apparently are in trouble. Mom bloggers are being sued. What's going on?
From the listenership, we
yes.
got this question.
So thank you to our listeners.
Social media question here on Legal Face Off.
The link is scarymommy.com.
Yes. So LuLaRoe, which is a legging company, has stirred up some controversy by posting their going out of business policy and procedures rather abruptly. This is a business that has consultants out in the field that actually sell the merchandise, and they're the ones that drive the company sales. And unfortunately, they are in a tough spot right now and are expressing their dissatisfaction on social media and otherwise. Apparently, LuLaRoe has, back in April, actually outlined policies and procedures for these very same consultants that sell their products to send their inventory back because it looked like the company might be going out of business. So many of these consultants who have thousands of dollars in inventory return their inventory but still have not seen their refunds. So amidst all of this controversy among the sales force at LuLaRoe, they are now suing Christina Hinks, who is the owner of the Mommy Giver Whistleblower blog. On this blog, Christina Hinks had shared some of the stories that she was hearing from the consultants and other people who were watching the company and were complaining about not only the sales policies but also their products. A week ago, the company sued Hinks, demanding that she divulge the sources of her information about the sales policies and said that her blog posts do not fall under journalistic protection, and also allege breach of contract, tortious interference, computer use violations, and fraud. I don't know about you, but I still believe in the First Amendment, Rich.
I do, but I'm not sure that I believe in the legging companies necessarily. I don't have much experience there, but Sam is the resident.
Oh, come on. You don't know anything about wearing leggings? Come on.
I have leggings
not so
on
much.
Right now.
Yeah, they're very...
That's why I was late today.
Yes.
Getting new leggings.
Your leggings burst at the seams.
But thank you to our listener for that great shout out and suggestion. Keep them coming.
Last but certainly not least, and we went long on this show, very long, the Starbucks robbery lawsuit.
My God. Again, I'm going to give a shout out to our former colleague, Jason Whiteside, for this one because it goes in the... People will sue for anything, column, and Jason Whiteside, we know, will sue anyone for anything. But this is a case where...
He'll sue you sometime,
exactly.
Rich.
It's that time of the month. It's a new month.
Exactly.
We have to get our knife in at Whiteside.
Yes. Yeah, so in July, in Fresno, California, there was a 30-year-old imbecile named Ryan Flores who tried to rob a Starbucks. By the way, he was wearing a Transformers mask while he was doing it, and a bystander, a patron on video named Craig Jerry, who is 58, stepped in to stop the crime. They got into a fight, and Craig, who was the bystander, took a chair and smacked this guy over the head like 20 times. They got into a fight and ended up, the perpetrator, the younger guy, ended up getting stabbed 17 times from this fight. So good on Craig Jerry for stepping up and stopping this and, you know, teaching this guy not to rob Starbucks. But guess what? The perpetrator turned around and is suing or has threatened to sue Starbucks and Ryan Flores for the injuries that he sustained in the fight. Never ceases to amaze you what goes on. I've actually had cases like that where I've defended retail stores that have defended armed robberies, and have shot the perpetrators, and the perpetrators come back and sue for excessive force when they're the ones who started it and are using guns and shooting up stores. So,
I mean, this just flies in the face of, you know, all that I hold holy in my life. But I mean, just it just seems like just from a torts perspective, it's like you create the endangering situation by behaving this way.
Well, the mom, his mom came out like on social media and said that, you know, he's a good boy. And the
he's so good that he goes in with a Transformers mask.
The customer was using excessive force. I'll just give a shout out to Craig Jerry. And if you need legal representation in this lawsuit, come call him. We'll help you out here on Legal Face Off.
Anything I missed?
That's it. Always. What do you think of the Blackhawks home opener last night?
It was nice.
Were you there?
That was a nice blowout.
I was there.
Welcome home, Brandon Saad.
Yes.
Oh, my God. I love that guy.
I actually had a question about Glenn Geffner. I'll save it for next week.
Okay.
The billboard guy, right? Yeah, the call this guy.
Glenn Lerner.
Oh, Glenn Lerner. Yes. Yeah, that guy. Yeah, I had a question about that, but it can obviously
maybe we'll have him on.
Okay, yeah, let's call that number. We'll get him on. Thanks to Rich and Tina. Thanks to Craig Collins. Thanks to all of our guests, including the bombastic Larry Levine. We'll talk to you next time on Legal Face Off.